This is the panel on revolution in the classroom, and we've got a great panel of revolutionaries up here for this panel. My name's Don Corrigan. I'm from Webster University in St. Louis, and I've been teaching environmental journalism for about 20 years now. What I'd like to do to start off this morning is to welcome you, and I hope some of you who are in academia come away with some good ideas after this panel session is over with. I came to environmental journalism through reporting, and the two big issues that I was covering in the 80s were the Three Mile Island transports of nuclear waste from TMI out to Idaho, and the other one was Times Beach and the buyout because of the town that was polluted by dioxin. So SEJ was a great way to find out information about those two disasters. So that's why I got involved with SEJ. I went to the first session organized in Boulder, Colorado, and I have to say that there was a Professor Colson there who was very helpful in encouraging me because I taught down the street at Webster University from the newspaper I work with, that he was very helpful in helping me put together a curriculum for this. So that's how I got into it, and that's how I want to sort of start this panel session, is do a little round robin with the folks we have this morning and ask them to talk about how they got into teaching environmental journalism, because I think everybody sort of takes a different route when it comes to getting in on the academic side. A lot of people start out with reporting, but they gravitate to the academic side. So our panelists this morning are Mark Seaman from Youngstown State University, and you may be familiar with his article in the summer SEJ Journal, which is a pretty interesting student project that he had, and he'll probably talk a little bit about that. Annie Laurie Blair from Miami University of Ohio, and I've been intrigued since talking with her about this panel at the Greenhawk website. I believe that's the correct name for it, so she may talk a little bit about how her students helped put that together. Sarah Shipley Hiles is from the University of Missouri School of Journalism, and I'm looking forward to learning more about what she does with field trips, and some of those field trips are international, which is particularly interesting. How do you pull that together? And finally, Robert Wiss from the University of Connecticut, who I'm happy to say I'm drawn on his knowledge with my classes because he's published a book which makes a great text for a course in environmental journalism. So again, I'd like to start off with a round robin with our panelists so that they can talk just a little bit about how they ended up in academia, how they ended up teaching environmental journalism, and how it fits into their program. So we'll start with Mark.
Good morning. Well, you know, I really believe, and as we give our presentations today, I hope to change your minds on this too, but all journalism should be environmental journalism. The theme of risk that permeates this conference is, if you understand risk, I think you understand that the environmental issues we face today really are the most compelling issues that we as journalists have to deal with. They are the only ones that really threaten to affect the future of humanity. You can't say that about most of the world news that we cover, the political news, certainly not the celebrity news. And so in a classroom setting, it's just made sense to me that these types of stories, this type of coverage, sort of rises to the top in terms of, what's the most important thing we can cover? Well, are these types of issues that usually have that environmental tone or underpinning to them. So, that's, I guess, what brought me into teaching environmental journalism. But again, I don't see it as something that we should segregate into a little category and call it, oh, this is environmental journalism, and everything else is the real journalism or the mainstream journalism. It shouldn't be seen that way, because I think that prevents it from ever really becoming, as prominent as it should be in our coverage. But that's the tone that I try to carry through all the classes that I teach in journalism.
I stumbled into environmental reporting really because of tragedies and situations at regular legacy media where I worked. In upstate New York, there was a cancer cluster at a local high school, and that sort of galvanized our staff to figure out why, you know, what was behind it, which turned out to be it had been built on a brownfield, and there was gook bubbling up in the backyard. And so many stories later, I realized I was doing environmental journalism. And after I left upstate New York, I went to the Cincinnati Enquirer, where there were just, you know, there's just a host of environmental issues around Southwest Ohio. And after I had been there for a while, I decided to leave and teach. And it took me actually a couple of years to start teaching and realize that with the downsizing in newsrooms across our region, there was very little high-quality environmental reporting going on in Southwest Ohio. We have Tom Henry in Toledo. We had Spencer Hunt. We have Spencer Hunt in Columbus. Jim Brookers in Louisville, but not too much going on in between, and I decided that my students could help fill that gap. So I look at teaching as an opportunity to improve the environmental conversation across mediums in Southwest Ohio, in Southeast Indiana, and in Northern Kentucky.
Hello, I'm Sarah Shipley Hiles, and I'm at the University of Missouri. I actually got my start right here in New Orleans, and it was fun for me last night. I got to go visit my old campus, Loyola University, uptown. That was a lot of fun, see my old newspaper, The Maroon. But I came into teaching the way a lot of folks do. I started out as a reporter and worked for various publications. Here, the Louisville Courier Journal, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and a place out in Oregon. And have always loved the environment, I guess, maybe because I grew up in a family of science geeks. But anyway, I've taught at three different universities now, and part of what I'm going to share is sort of some of the different things I've learned at those different places. But I'm very happy to be here.
I'm Bob Wiss. I worked 28 years at the Providence Journal, and early on I got interested in teaching. I actually started adjunct teaching in 1980. So when I had the opportunity in 2002 to jump to it full time at the University of Connecticut, I did. So I've been there about 12 years. The environmental journalism aspect, I had done a lot of environmental journalism as a reporter. It was a natural sort of teaching for me to do once I started teaching at the University of Connecticut, which is entirely, our journalism program is entirely undergraduate, so that helps too. And So I teach a couple different environmental journalism classes, but one of the things I've been doing is collaborating with particularly somebody in the biology department and doing more interdisciplinary work with graduate science students on teaching them how to communicate too, and that's one of the things I'm going to talk about today.
Okay, so we've had an introduction about how people have gotten into it. I imagine a lot of people that are in this room who are teaching probably also followed the route where they started as reporters. I always find it interesting how the journalistic mindset sort of doesn't always fit in with the academic mindset. But it's also one of the things I think that brings a lot of innovation to the classroom that you don't normally find from a lot of academics and other traditions. So one of the things we're going to do now is just have folks talk a little bit about what they do that's revolutionary. This panel has been hyped as a revolution in the classroom, so that's a heavy burden on all the panelists to talk about what they do that's revolutionary. So we may not go in the same order, but I'll start with Mark on this.
All right, thank you. I don't know that what I do is revolutionary, but I'm regretfully, I think it's unusual and uncommon in the classroom, and so let me tell you a little bit about it. Yeah, please. What I do, and what anybody could do, if you believe strongly in this stuff that we call environmental journalism, and I would assume that you do, being that you're here today, it's really something that's easy to incorporate into virtually any journalism class that you teach. It belongs there. It really does. And I want to share with you some of the ways that I do it. But you know, these are not, you know, patented techniques by any means. It's nothing that anybody couldn't do with just some imagination and the desire to do so. For instance, in a news writing class, which, you know, I think is very common, probably I can't imagine a journalism program that wouldn't have the introduction to news writing or news reporting. It's a ubiquitous course. The ways that it can be brought to bear in that class are, well, number one, beats. If you have your students, you know, generating content, have an environmental journalism beat where you push them to look for these types of stories. Advocacy assignment. This is something that I do. Part of what I have my students do are what I call open topic stories, where instead of being assigned a topic, they've got to go find a newsworthy topic and write about it. Well, for one or two of them that I have them do every semester, I require that it be an example of advocacy journalism, where they're trying to promote, you know, some positive social good vis-a-vis some agenda. I require one of them to be, you know, environmental or about sustainability. And so that prompts them to explore something that they otherwise might not have. If you cover the elements of newsworthiness in your news writing class, whether it's from a textbook or whether it's a list that you've compiled on your own as part of a lecture or a discussion, you know, folding risk and you know, sustainability and environmentalism into that list of things that contain social utility and that really correspond with the role of the media to do social good. I think you can bring it up in that way as well. If you review the day's news in a news writing class, you know, to keep students abreast on current events, whether that's debriefing on, you know, front pages of various newspapers, looking at the leads in various stories, there's a great opportunity to key in on stories of that type, environmental journalism stories, or even better, point out ways in which stories that do not in any way incorporate environmental journalism or sustainability or any of those themes into them, but should, stories that ought to be talking about, you know, those things and that ought to have as part of them dimensions of the environment, you know, point that out when you discuss the stories and say, you know, this story covered some topic that, you know, they could have had an environmental angle to it, but it didn't because whoever wrote it just chose not to look at it in that way, but could have, and it probably would have been a better story had they done so. So in a news writing class, a lot of ways to do it. In a media ethics class, I would assume that some of the ways to incorporate environmental journalism into the curriculum should be obvious, but one is in a discussion of, well, objectivity, advocacy journalism, social responsibility, truth-telling. All of those themes are conversation points, discussion points on which you can bring, you know, the idea of doing environmental journalism or turning your reporting into environmental reporting, can bring that into play. The idea of objectivity as a stumbling block or an obstacle to doing environmental journalism. Well, you know, we don't want to appear biased in these stories, or, we don't want to cheerlead, you know, on the side of environmentalists and seem to be railing against, you know, industry or business or something like that. You point out to the students, well, but by maintaining objectivity or attempting to be quote-unquote objective in covering the story, usually what you're doing is really just reinforcing the status quo. You're not including anything in the story that indicates there's any need for change. What that does is it reinforces the idea that what we have right now is fine. There is no need for change. And the status quo is usually, on these issues, you know, in the laps of industry and polluters and not where we want to see things going. And so it's not really being objective at all. It's actually taking a side, but in a way that you wouldn't immediately assume. You know, advocacy journalism, we talked about that a little bit already in the news writing example, but the ways to incorporate it into there. In an ethics class, you can talk about the need to do social good. The social responsibility of the media is to do good by society. And every one of the issues that we would categorize as environmental can do that. Truth-telling. The media have an obligation to tell the truth. Well, the truth is that we have big problems with, you know, a lot of things that are environmentally based or that have to do with so-called environmentalism or environmental topics. If we ignore that or don't bring that out in our stories, we're not telling the truth. We're really not. We're sort of mudding the truth up by confusing people over what's really important. A research project, which is, you know, what was the basis of the article that Don mentioned in the journal that Sarah helped me get into print this summer. I had my students look at stories, just front page stories that were selected, not randomly, but systematically for research purposes. But and they basically did a content analysis where they assigned them as either having, you know, significant long-term potential that story would really affect society in the long term, or that maybe it wouldn't. And when they categorized all of the stories on the front page of a newspaper as either having long-term potential implications for society or not, it's amazing how many of the stories that ended up in the former category were what we would call environmental journalism. It's this type of reporting that's really going to matter in the long term. And that's the takeaway from a research project like that. And it's something that you could do in any media ethics class. And it would really show the students why this stuff matters so much more than we seem to want to admit that it does as a society or even as an institution in journalism. A history class, a journalism history class. And you can look at the role of the media in the rise of the conservation ethic when this nation was first entertaining the idea that maybe we should move away from the concept of manifest destiny and start to, you know, conserve a little, save a little, when we had folks like Muir and Leopold doing their stuff. You know, the media were part of that. The media helped give rise to that, and there's plenty of stories, case studies in history to look at. Muckraking in the progressive era of the media were, you know, among other things, we did a lot of good environmental journalism back in the early 1900s. We got away from that, came back to it a little bit in the 70s, but it's fallen by the wayside again compared with what it was at its height. In a history class, it's impossible not to notice how the media change over time. They've never been the same for very long. The face of the media is constantly changing. And surely, 20, 50 years into the future, the media are going to be different than they are today. How they'll be different depends upon where we take them. One of the best directions I think we could take them would be to kind of embrace a more serious approach to our environmental reporting. If you teach workshop-type classes, again, to have a beat, a specific beat for environmental journalism, and with individual story ideas that maybe just aren't from a beat, you can encourage students to recognize that there's a quote-unquote environmental angle to that story that they can bring out and kind of raise to the forefront, even if it's not a story from that beat. You know, it has a component, a dimension to it that could be brought out. Various writing classes, any of the, you know, whether it's an editorial or opinion writing class, a feature writing class, magazine writing class, online news class, all of those have, you know, obvious and great potential, you know, for editorials, for features, for magazine, longer magazine feature pieces. It's just limited only by your imagination in terms of how you can incorporate environmental journalism into these classes. A media law class is equally easy with all of the FOIA issues, dealing with regulatory agencies that really don't seem to be on the side of regulating what they're supposed to regulate, dealing with industry. Those are all topics that can be brought into play to a media ethics class. You know, I happen to be teaching a freshman composition class this semester in the English department, and one of the things that I did was incorporated a reading out of Joel Greenberg, just published a book this summer about the extinction of the passenger pigeon. It's titled A Feathered River Across the Sky. I had him read a selection out of that book and then do a response to it in that composition class. But the media, the mainstream media, have missed an opportunity to do an appreciation of what happened. It was 100 years ago last Monday that the last passenger pigeon in the world died at the Cincinnati Zoo, September 1st, 1914. The centenary of that tragic event was just last week. What an opportunity to do some environmental journalism, because that story, if you're familiar with what happened to the passenger pigeon, you know, the lessons that could have been learned from that and applied today are myriad. But most of them have not taken hold and have not been observed. But it's really a lesson for the ages that, unfortunately, in my experience, most people don't even know what a passenger pigeon is, let alone know the intricacies of the story of how we drove them to extinction in a few decades' time. So, you know, very easy to incorporate this stuff into any journalism class, and probably one of the most valuable modifications you could make to your curriculum if you really want, you know, high-value hands-on journalism for your students is to make every class an environmental journalism class to some extent.
I do like the way Mark finds a way to incorporate environmental journalism in all these classes. I'm a little conspiratorial. It sounds like a way to build a program, but if you haven't had a chance to read his article in this issue of SCJ Journal, I think it's a great example of doing a content analysis project with your classes, and it's a way to get them reading the newspapers to see what's in there. I sometimes have difficulty with my students with that. So we're going to skip over to Sarah Shipley-Hiles, and she's going to talk about some of the things that she does, and we're asking her to go next because the other panelists, set what they have sort of feeds into what she's going to tell us. So.
Okay, hello again. Sarah Shipley-Hiles with the University of Missouri. And I'm going to focus on field reporting. How many folks in here have done field reporting excursions with your students? Most people. Okay. So the first thing I want to do is acknowledge that I am not the first, nor maybe even the best, example of field reporting, but what I am going to do is talk about my own experiences at three different schools and three sort of different levels, different types of field reporting experiences that you can do depending on your resources and the students that you have. So I've pulled up this first example here. At the University of Missouri, we have a giant journalism school, 2,000 students, lots of faculty. We do all kinds of things. And my colleague, Bill Allen, who isn't here this year, leads a lot of field reporting trips, and I regard him as a mentor and really an example. So I just wanted to point out Bill and acknowledge all the work that's gone before me, but if you look at the top of this page, this shows you some of the places that Bill has taken students to Costa Rica. They've done the Sandhill Crane trip. They've gone to Florida. They've gone to Hawaii. They've gone all around Missouri on field reporting trips, and it's pretty neat. But how did I get into this? Well, I had been a newspaper reporter who then went freelance, and I decided that I would try teaching. And it was my second semester of teaching at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky, that I thought, you know, what I would really like to do is take my freshman intro to news writing class and do this field reporting experience. So being kind of young and naive, I planned out this extremely elaborate trip and ran it all on a shoestring. So these were freshmen, okay? It was in the fall, so these were like brand new freshman students who were just new on a college campus, new to the journalism program, and I thought, I'm going to take these kids over fall break. They're going to have to give up their fall break, and I'm going to take them into Appalachia, and we're going to spend the entire fall break together in a 15-passenger van. And that is what we did. It ended up being an experience I'm sure none of them will ever forget. But this was back in 2007, and you can see the website there. You know, it looks really antique. I kind of enjoy looking at it now. But in order to plan for that trip, I decided I would go ahead and scope it out. So I took several days and went to all the places I thought might be interesting. I met with sources, I prearranged interviews, I thought about what the stories would be. I checked out a place for us to stay. We stayed at the Pine Mountain Settlement School, which was this really cool WPA-era place. And, you know, we went to like a cultural festival, we went to a mountaintop mining site, we went to an underground mine. We just did all kinds of things over these 5 days. and we packed it in and made them watch films. I had them read books, and it was just total immersion. And the whole semester we kind of used to work on this project. And then when we came back, I had them actually write 3 stories apiece that went onto this website and collaborated with a web design class to build the site. So that was my first big project. Then I got a little bit even more ambitious over time and had the opportunity to go to India with students. And this was quite a different experience because it was part of a class. This class was a more advanced class, and we were focusing on agriculture. So as part of that, I went with a different group of students to India, and I had only one student who was able to fund that portion of the trip. And we went and reported on the problem of farmer suicides in India, which if you haven't heard of that problem, is probably one of the most tragic things that I've ever had the opportunity to write about, where basically farmers in India, due to groundwater depletion and climate change and a whole host of other issues, find that they can't repay their debts and they end up killing themselves. More than 10,000 farmers have killed themselves in India, and that's considered to be an underestimate, a government number. But anyway, so that trip was very different because I didn't have the chance to pre-report. My student and I went there. We had some contacts. Sometimes with international reporting, you can't make a bunch of contacts ahead of time. You have to sort of, you know, rely on people when you get there. The culture of sort of making appointments isn't always the same. So we, you know, had a very small bit of money, and we traveled on the cheap and, you know, hired taxi drivers to take us around and, you know, found all these stories. And we came home and put that together as part of this greater class package. And as part of that same class, we did a lot of local trips as well. And that's the third thing that I wanted, the third type of field excursion I wanted to mention is local. Just because, you know, people talk about doing these incredible trips to India and Costa Rica and wherever doesn't mean that you shouldn't overlook the opportunity to do things in your own backyard. So as part of that same ag reporting class, we visited a dairy farm, for example, the largest one in the state of Kentucky. And when I was at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, which was the second school that I taught at, I had a class that was actually an environmental journalism class that time. And in order to make it work logistically, because the class only met 2 days a week, and this wasn't the type of course that had the opportunity to take a extended field trip somewhere, we would take walking field trips on campus. So we went, for example, to the the student center, and we talked to them about sustainability with their food production and waste composting. So don't overlook those simple opportunities to do things like, go to your local creek and have a water quality expert come and show you how to do dip netting or something like that. Those things that are very small can be just as useful, and if you have a short class period and you don't have the opportunity to do these more elaborate things, that's a great experience too, and you all can do that together. So some of the logistics that have to go into thinking about field trip classes would be course credits. So is this going to be a one credit class? Is this going to be a weekend or a semester long thing? Some of our more elaborate classes are actually credited out over 2 semesters, like a spring and a fall. Maybe for even up to 6 credits, depending how long it is. The schedules of the class and the students. So as I mentioned, if your class is meeting Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you really want to, you know, bring some kind of field reporting experience in, maybe you just arrange with a botanist and you go out to the quad and you talk about tree identification and have your students build a Google map that shows trees around the quad. I mean, it could be something that simple. Transportation is always an issue that you have to put a lot of thought into. So how are you going to get where you're going? And I've done everything from, you know, renting a van, driving it myself. I even recruited my poor dad. My dad drove our 15-passenger van to Eastern Kentucky, and he has never forgiven me because the roads were so scary. I've had students transport themselves. I have taken planes and trains and automobiles with students. So, you know, I think it can work at any level that you want it to, if you can get the students on board with it. Pre-planning, I've done it both ways, both the elaborate pre-planning where, mapping out stories ahead of time and telling the students this is what you're going to do, to letting them discover what those stories would be. And I think it's nice to sometimes have the students write as they go and kind of blog as they're having these experiences, but then come back and do stories afterward as well where they can apply more research and analysis and reporting. As far as cost, I've done it on a shoestring. You know, you can make a walking field trip cost basically nothing. You know, you can get grant funding sometimes or special funding on your campus. It just depends. Some programs at our school have had outside funding from other media organizations or other types of partners. So obviously travel, anytime you're talking about travel, you could be looking at expense. So that's something you really have to think about ahead of time. And then technology and tools, what kinds of equipment will your students need? Do they have access to it? Can they check it out from a central pool? Do they have their own devices? What kind of training do you need to provide them? So do your students already know how to use iMovie or Final Cut Pro in order to produce videos, or do you need to incorporate that training, or can you outsource that training if necessary? Those are all things to take into consideration. And then with publishing, I know that these folks are going to talk about publishing as well, but it's super easy to do the DIY way of publishing, where you open up a WordPress.com account and for free, you know, you create a microsite for your project. I've done it that way. I have worked with classes, sometimes collaborating with web production classes, so that it becomes a team effort where we produce the content and they produce the online portion of it. And, you know, that can work very well. It can also be more complicated. And then, you know, letting the students publish to some partner, whether that is, you know, an established media outlet or if your campus already has a publication that is willing to receive that content. Maybe you have your own environmental journalism publication already. Not every school has that. I've worked at schools that have had or not had those kinds of publications. So I think whichever way you go, it doesn't really matter as long as the students are getting that experience and getting those clips and getting that content out there. I just believe so strongly in that. And lastly, I would be remiss if I did not mention the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources as a little bit of inspiration. I don't know if most of you are familiar with this group already. I'm a new board member to IJNR, but this is a group that does professional training for journalists, and you should definitely look them up and or apply. And so they take people out on field excursions for multiple days, sometimes, I think maybe even up to 2 weeks, some of the longer ones were. But that really kind of set the tone for me as a working journalist and kind of understanding what it takes to put together a complex field trip. And that proved very beneficial for me later when I got into teaching and thought that that was something that I wanted to do. They're not geared towards students right now, but I'm interested in, you know, sort of pursuing that, so we'll see what direction that goes.
So we're running a little behind, so I want to make sure that there's time for questions. At this point, we'll move to Annie Laurie Blair. She'll talk about some of the field experiences she does.
So I'm Annie Blair. I've been teaching at Miami of Ohio for 10 years. And for those of you who don't know, Miami of Ohio is actually a public school. It's about 18,000 students, most of them undergraduates. It's in southwest Ohio, John Boehner territory. And so we do teach mostly undergraduates. We have no graduate journalism students. And we do have an awful lot of journalism students, though, who've gone on to professional careers. I guess, you know, the other exciting alumna might be like the quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, the pundit, P.J. O'Rourke. Nick Lachey never made it to the final line to get his degree there. It is an unusual campus in that 40+% of our students are from out of state or out of the country, and it's also high cost. And so what we get is a bunch of students that are not even the last child in the woods. They come from suburban areas. They have very little experience, really, in wilderness areas or in natural areas. They tend to go to the rec a lot and work out. So one of the 13 student-run medias on our campus today is Green Hawks Media, and it's focused entirely on environmental issues, health, sustainability, And it is a publication, an online publication that I helped found through my environmental journalism class and have been advising ever since. In 2012, Green Hawks Media, which actually plays off of our athletic team, the Miami Red Hawks, not the conservative angle you might think. In 2012, Green Hawks Media won a Midwest Mark of Excellence Award for the best independent online student publication from SPJ, the Society of Professional Journalists. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Green Hawks Media because, like Sarah, a lot of my curriculum in my class is focused on field trips and producing for local media. But my hope is that those of you who teach environmental journalism will see the value and be inspired to launch such a media on your own campus. And those of you who may be professional media, that you'll see the value in taking student work on, as long as you have, you know, someone like me or another professional journalist who would edit the work and check the facts for you. So that's actually an important part of what Green Hawks Media staff have been able to do. And I'll talk about their cross-publication a little bit. I don't know if all these things are working. So these are just some images from some of the field trips that we have been on. One of the key reasons I really started teaching environmental journalism at Miami was just this void in environmental reporting in the region. And so, again, I thought really my students could help fill that gap. When I left the Cincinnati Inquirer in 2004, they basically ditched the environmental beat shortly after that. And while a lot of nonprofit work has helped fill some of the information channels, there's just, you know, there's just not a voice. There's not a voice for citizens, and there's not a voice for residents, and not enough knowledge, frankly, about health and sustainability and water and air quality there. So when I taught the first class, what happened was that it was an interdisciplinary group of students. They certainly weren't all journalism majors. There was a PhD in zoology in the class. And I challenged them to start thinking about storytelling in different forms. So from the get-go in 2009, they were thinking visually, creating video, creating stories. But the real success was that they, you know, I helped them, I helped facilitate their publication in regional media. So even that first class, we were able to publish stories in the Cincinnati Inquirer, in the Alternative Weekly in Cincinnati, and my campus is actually 45 minutes from Cincinnati, so that's one benefit, is we're very close, and you may be close to other cities and other media that might expand your coverage. So we're also about 50 minutes from Dayton. So we were able to publish across several media. Cox Media Ohio now has most of the publications in our region. Dayton Daily News, what used to be the Hamilton Journal, Journal News now, the Oxford Press, and WHIO TV and radio. So they were important from the beginning. The students felt like the work that they were doing, you know, they're really striving for professional quality. And that was just a bar that I set for them, and they really rose to that. So I prodded them to think about what the next step would be. And, you know, you can't just have a trickle. I only teach this class once every other year right now. Can't have a trickle of those stories coming through. And I really felt like the students could do more, and they agreed with me. And so that first year, I brought two of the students who'd been in that class to SEJ in Madison. And I have to think that, you know, when I challenged them, could we somehow solidify this effort? I think SEJ and their experience in Madison had a phenomenal effect on them and made them realize that there are so many other issues than some of the ones they were thinking about in class, and they could perhaps form their own media, which they did. And they had a third student, also an economics and environmental science major, who served as their business manager. So they got funding from Student Activities Council and got some computer equipment. We knew we wanted to be an online-only media, and they got some office space, And they didn't have to deal with things like the cost of printing. They didn't have to deal with the, you know, actually creating display ads. They just could start creating content. So it's had some, in the years since then, it's had some successes, some big successes, including the SPJ Award, some big successes in reporting, but also some failures, I would say. And I was talking to Dave Polson about this last year because the staff at its height had about 22 people and they were producing all kinds of content. They had a pretty lively YouTube channel. They had strong social media and their stories were getting out and getting a lot of sort of views in different places. But last year the staff dropped to 3 and they lost the password for their YouTube channel. And you know, and the interest on campus sort of disappeared. So I would say only about half of the students over time have been journalism majors. They've come from all walks of life, but you know, their stories really ranged from hard-hitting opinion pieces on the coal use on our campus to water quality issues. We're not far from a former uranium processing plant where they're still testing and there are trickles of uranium getting into our watershed. But you know, there are a lot of stories about hemp clothing and vegetarian diets. So you know, there was a lot of softness to some of their work. I've not seen a lot of idealistic zealot, you know, sort of zealot behavior or writing. Not a lot of advocacy type pieces, but what I have seen is that if you don't prod them, they will not, you know, strive toward public affairs gotcha stories using a lot of data. And last year, actually this, the previous frame there, what they did was to revive the media. They formed a partnership with our main student media. Like I said, we have 12, 13 student media. They range from literary news magazines to I am also the advisor to the fashion magazine. I don't know how that happened. But so there are a lot of different media, and then what they did was arrange a partnership with the main student media, the Miami Student, which has had a lot of award-winning work. And they basically became sort of like a their own staff. So there was a cross-publication, and what I had showed you was stories that were published in Greenhawks Media Online and in the Miami Student. And they use, cross-pollinate their logos and links online, and then the work is disseminated across social media through both. So that's been very successful. As an unpaid advisor, though, I don't, for liability reasons, edit their copy. And so one of the downsides I see is I don't regularly meet with the entire staff. I meet mainly with the editors. And my class has become disconnected from their work in many ways. And so that's a problem. And I don't know, you know, as you think perhaps about whether you can do these kinds of things, what kind of oversight would you as the professional want to have over the student work? And, you know, since I'm not paid for it, it's always that dynamic of how much time do I spend? How much? And in my class, I'm teaching a lot of, you know, public records work, environmental law, techniques on interviewing scientists and farmers, and taking a lot of field trips to expose them to stakeholders in the environment. And the student media, Greenhawks, you know, isn't getting that steady diet, and not all of the staff members are taking my class. So it's a downside to that. So we haven't quite figured out how to get that back together. One heartening thing, though, this is a picture of a new portion of campus we just rebuilt. My campus, which I think when I first started teaching environmental journalism, had a C- or D rating from the old college sustainability report card. I don't know if you guys remember that. But in the interim, they have just reinvented campus, and this particular picture is of the new geothermal campus. They built a $9 million geothermal plant. They built 3 new dorms. There's a lake and native plantings. And signage is going up to explain what all of it is. About 25% of the food we serve on campus is grown within a 100-mile radius. And Ohio House Bill 251 required a 20% reduction in energy consumption for the past 10 years since this date, but my university has really pushed that beyond and set goals for 2020 that I think will make the campus so much more green in many different ways. So that's all very good for me. And the momentum is there to engage students and have them do the kinds of reporting that I think they can do. And since then I should mention, and Bob's going to talk about, I've broadened and now I teach a class in environmental communication to master's and graduate students in the sciences, and there's a huge faculty interdisciplinary momentum. I'm a part of a partnership that's trying to think about different, you know, viral video ways to communicate science. I guess I'd leave you with this. I asked the current editor of GreenHawks, Olivia Broad, if she would talk about why she's committed to this work, and she told me, we have the opportunity to make improvements and changes that are necessary to stop environmental damage or even reduce the damage we and past generations have done. So if we can inform ourselves and act on that knowledge, you know, we need to start those conversations and then turn that conversation into action. So clearly she does have an advocacy perspective, but she's trying to do it objectively, if you will. Thanks.
So we'll move on to Bob. I like that Annie talked about problems, and sometimes those problems on field trips, especially if they're not sort of mentored. I had students who went to Times Beach, the dioxin disaster zone, and they ended up in the Eureka, Missouri jail because they crossed over some lines they weren't supposed to. So bailing out students was not one of the things I anticipated for field trip work. So Bob?
I'm sure you guys haven't noticed this, but I have noticed that with my undergraduate students, they consider an interview an email with three questions on it. I'm sure none of you have had that kind of experience. I think interviewing is one of the things that's kind of a lost art, okay? And at least in our program, and I suspect in a lot of journalism programs, interviewing is not something that we spend enough time on. And so as I was thinking about that a few years ago, I came up with this course. And I do it in collaboration with a biology professor who is an Aldo Leopold fellow and is really big into science communication. And what we do is we essentially pair graduate science students with undergraduate journalism students, and we have these interview sessions. And we started by having the interviews live in the classroom. So, you know, we'd have 25 or 30 people in the classroom, and they'd have to do a 30-minute interview live. And we did videotape it, but we just didn't have time. We wanted to show the videotape afterwards, and that just didn't work. We ran out of time. And the students were a little nervous, you know, interviewing live like that. So we moved on to a system where essentially they do the interview in advance, and it's videotaped, and then we show the videotape in class, and we critique it. And we critique both the science student as far as their ability to convey fairly complex information, and we also critique the journalism student as far as understanding that complex information and trying to translate it and understand it. And I have a few just very brief clips, which I hope will demonstrate just a little bit about what we're trying to do.
I work in a electrophysiology lab, so I do mostly biophysical methods in studying the brain.
Okay, so electrophysiology is...
So that's pretty much an umbrella term for recording electrical stimuli between neurons and how they signal with each other. So.
Okay, and what exactly is your research? What does it entail?
That's a very hard question to answer, actually.
In fact, it was such a hard question. In 30 minutes, he could never really answer just exactly what he did. This guy on the science side was just a disaster. In fact, he just washed out of the class because it was just too hard for him to understand that he has to master that if he ever is going to talk to the public. She did a really good job trying to break it down. It just didn't work.
the big project that I just finished is looking at the global distribution of sacred forest.
All right, and what about the global distribution?
So what we find in the historical record is that around the world, basically every culture has at some point or another worshipped trees.
And so what I found was that more forest edges in the surrounding area also influenced how many invasive plants you found there.
And a forest edge would be, I mean, just generally it would be like the outskirts of a forest?
That's exactly right.
And what's the delineation between, say, the forest edge and the interior of the forest, or the core forest, I believe the term is?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Okay. So those work, okay? That's just classic interviewing. That's what you teach them. You teach them to make sure you absolutely understand everything. Here's one that didn't work.
So just take an example of the fire ants story. It is known as the most notorious invasive ant species in the United States. Which
is the Microrubra that you study. Is that how you pronounce it?
I'm sorry, no. Microrubra.
Is that a type of fire ant?
The common name for that is known as the European fire ant. So it has some similarity with the fire ant, the red imported fire ant that I just mentioned, but they are actually distantly related, so they're not actually in the same genus.
Okay, so she interrupted, she didn't understand, she got really mixed up with the types of fire ants. She never really did understand it all the way through. So that kind of shows you the way the course really works. You know, we try and be positive when we give the feedback and stuff like that, but they come out of it learning a great deal. So the journalism department kind of got excited about this, and we moved it to sort of the next level, where we started using mini iPads as the video camera. And mini iPads can work really well. You just set up with a tripod and with a very simple mic, and you don't position people the way you positioned them in that particular situation. And you can have students do things like multimedia presentations. So here's just a portion of one taking two of the interview sessions, which were positioned differently, and it was part of a multimedia report.
Construes it to make us seem like, terrorists or, savages or whatever. They don't really like us.
Misconceptions are something that can be easily corrected through just education. There's extremists in every religion, and it should be stressed that just because a certain group of people are doing this in the name of a religion doesn't mean that the entire religion is what they're trying to make a point of.
Obviously, that was a non-environmental journalism course, but this was the evolution of what occurred. And we haven't really done this with an environmental journalism interview in class yet, but we probably will. And what I wanted to show you on that particularly was the quality seems to hold up. So we've been doing this for several semesters. It seems to work. We thought we were really on the road during one of the very first interviews. And one of my classic examples of this is that there was an interview with somebody who was a moss expert, and she mentioned that mosses were a great carbon sink. He said, yeah, that's interesting. And then he went on and asked her more questions, right? Afterwards, we asked him, did you understand what a carbon sink was? No. We asked the interviewee, did you understand that he didn't understand that what a carbon sink was? No. So that's, those are like when the light bulb things happen. It's just great for teaching and for learning, because you've got those kinds of opportunities right there happening. So I'm really sold on this concept, and I recommend you try and do it.
Well, thanks, Bob. This was advertised as a revolutionary, but even more a grab bag panel, and I think we succeeded with that. So we've got a little time for questions. Everybody here probably knows the drill, no speech making, and please ID yourselves when you preface your questions. So anybody have a question to start things off?
Hi. Dan Fagan. I've always been attracted to this field trip idea, but my concern always is that it's just so unrealistic and that we're doing so much for them. We're really spoon-feeding them. And so I have really moved away from that because I kind of feel like the logistical aspects of figuring out who to interview and how and when and... I mean, that's a huge part of learning to be a reporter. So I understand the attraction of the field trips, but I wonder, the group field trips, but I wonder if it's actually good training for journalism. And I wonder if those of you, Sarah and others who run field trips, can react to that.
My reaction to that is that I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think it's all of the above. And depending on the level of the student that you're taking, it's really good sort of demonstration to them as to what you should be doing. And when you have them there as a group, like when I took the group to Eastern Kentucky, they all observed each other interviewing sources, they observed me speaking to the sources, and I think that was really educational for them. But at the same time, that's just one class out of their entire career in journalism school, so... Hopefully they'll take what they've learned and then apply it. But I would agree, you don't want to, for that to be the only time that they have field experiences. They don't have to go out and do it on their own.
Annie Blair here. I would just say I think the field trips for most of my students have been the most incredible experiences for them. An example would be last fall we took a canoe trip down an urban waterway in Cincinnati, and our intent was to create a bunch of journalistic content for the Mill Creek Watershed Council that oversaw this creek and all the other tributaries. And along the way, they brought their iPhones and they interviewed some of the scientists who went with us and some of the volunteers. And the stories were that much richer for the experience they had actually going down this creek, this waterway that had been polluted for so many decades. And I just, you know, that was invaluable. And other field trips, I haven't gotten as, as exotic as you have, Sarah, but I think those getting out of the classroom things have been really meaningful.
Okay, we have another question back here.
Dave Polson. Bob, really intrigued by your technique there. I was wondering if you prepped your students with by teaching interviewing skills before that exercise, or did you use it primarily as a teaching exercise in retrospect? And if you had them write off the interview afterwards, and maybe you could comment a little bit on why you paired undergrads and grad students as opposed to kind of a peer-to-peer science undergrad, journalism undergrad.
There's a lot of questions, Dave. yes, there is a fair amount of prep. We review interviewing techniques and things like that with a couple lecture discussion type courses, classes. They get together with the science student before the interview, just as you would if you know, you always do some prep. I mean, that's one of the things you're taught, is before you do the interview, you do a lot of prep. So they're allowed to do some of that. And the science student gives them a certain amount of information. They can give them technical papers or things like that, or they can direct them to their website. The graduate versus the undergraduate, I'm trying to find people. These are mostly PhD candidates, and they're talking about their research. And they have to learn, you know, with the NSF grants the way they are these days, it's happening everywhere all around the country that they have to learn these kinds of skills. So it's just an easy, ready-made target. The writing thing has always been kind of a dilemma, not a dilemma. It's been a challenge as far as figuring out just how much I should require them to write and how I should structure it as a one credit, a two credit, or a three credit. And I've gone from one credit to three credit on these things because the scientists, the science students, they want to know what these guys are going to write. And I couldn't really do that with a one-credit course, and that's how I kind of wanted to do it. But they really were insistent that they wanted to see it because they were concerned about the interpretation, not during the interview, but the interpretation when they actually wrote the story. So that's why we went to the three-credit sort of concept. And I do some editing, and I make sure there's a second draft. Just because they're going to be torn, they're going to be critiqued rather, you know, not harshly, but they're going to be critiqued openly, and I want to control that a little bit. So that's pretty much the way that works.
Okay, we have another question here.
Hi, Meg Turvelheitz. I just wanted to follow up on what you were saying. Can you describe a little bit how you made that arrangement with the grad students? Are they getting any kind of credit out of it, and do they actually review the final articles and talk to the student about accuracy, kind of giving a little bit of back and forth on how they interpreted it?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a weird situation where we have where what we finally came up with was a three-credit undergraduate course, a journalism course, with a one-credit graduate science seminar that then meets together, and we do that. And yes, the science students then do get to see the story. We don't usually show it to them. We post it a day or so before the class, so everybody in the class can see it, including the person who was interviewed. And, you know, so they can look for, obviously, the main thing is to look for factual errors, then nuances as far as, you know, what the inference was. And it's in some ways, it's invaluable for them because they learn a lot about the mistakes they have made in communicating, where they obviously were too vague or not clear enough on things. So it works both ways.
Another question? I'd just like to say I like that idea of interviewing graduate students. I know when I got my master's at Mizzou, the Wall Street Journal did a story about how there was one reporter for every 50 people in the town, and that meant all the officials and professors were, you know, inundated every day by reporters trying to ask questions, and a lot of officials just shut down. So I think it's a novel idea to go to graduate students.
Well, let me just add one thing about this, because this has been an evolution as I work with these graduate science students, and you know, I'm still... What I'm mostly doing is still teaching journalism and teaching journalism classes, but we keep evolving this class. And so we have a one-credit journalism class we've opened up this particular semester to really only graduate science students. And we've sort of taken the next step where we're starting to teach them how to write or how to produce some sort of multimedia report which they can post on their website or something like that. So they can take the next step in communicating and go beyond just talking to people, you know, talking to journalists or things like that. If they want, they can talk directly to the general public. So I don't know how, you know, this class is an experiment. I have like 8 students we've just started, and I'll tell you at some later date how it's going to go.
How about another question on field trips, too, this morning? I know that I live in St. Louis. We've got so many environmental problems in St. Louis that there's more possibilities for local field trips than there are students to go around for those. That's one of the advantages of being in an urban area.
Yeah, I was just going to add with what Bob said that I hope most of you are reaching out to your science faculty on your campuses and thinking about ways to expand the curriculum. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm teaching this environmental communication class for grad science students now, and they're having a blast learning how to shoot video. And we did a summer seminar that was funded by our Miami Research Office, in which we took research produced on campus and turned it into completely different products. One was a print art series, another was spoken poetry interspersed with scientific data.
My group did a video over flying a major watershed in a plane and shooting video from above of different problems. And we're going to do that in an exhibit this fall. We're just going to have our own, you know, art exhibit in a local community center. So if you try different things like that, I think that's what the way that we turn scientists into better communicators.
Yeah, we've had an interesting discussion here on interviewing, not something I anticipated, but one little idea I'd like to throw out that I think plays nicely off of what you do with the interviewing videotape. I have my students interview each other. They come up with a topic about which each one of them is an expert on or something they have a lot of experience with, and then they interview each other. And then the debriefing on that, one of the things that I emphasize is that they reflect on how it felt to be interviewed. And, you know, from the interviewee's standpoint, you know, what could have gone better, and you know, were they comfortable that the person interviewing them was getting it right and handling it right. And I think that addresses a little bit of the same thing, but from a different vantage point.
So we've got time for one more short question. I think I saw somebody over here.
Hi, my name's Mick Guzinadafi. I work at University of Georgia Press. I'm curious, you've spoken about practicing interviewing and interacting with scientists. Do you have your students interact with social scientists, urban planners, other departments across the academy?
Actually, when I set up this most recent class, I actually wanted to expand it to, you know, any graduate student in the university. I think there'll be a big demand for this, but the woman I'm working with in the biology department was, you know, she just wanted to have her people. So, yeah, I expect that we will be expanding it dramatically and expanding more of this as we go along.
I would say absolutely. You know, as far as working with field trips and things like that, you would want to be reaching out to the spectrum of, you know, sources who would be involved in a given issue, and that would include social scientists and people from the hard sciences to talk about that perspective, people in the community, perhaps activists, businesses, whatever that might be, to try to give the students a good grounding in, you know, what are the types of sources that you'll need to talk to, and if you can get those people in the field to talk to you during a field trip, all the better.
So when we started out this morning, we thought we were going to be a little lonely in here. So I want to thank everybody for coming to our session, and let's have a round of applause for our panelists.